Welcome to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio, and welcome back to The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. In tonight's episode, we join Jonathan and his family in Paris.
If I could send my mother a postcard, I would tell her Anya has discovered she loves croissants. I would tell her how we bought three for breakfast from a tiny bakery and ate them from the paper sacks as we strolled vaguely through a drizzle toward the river. And I would tell her how we crossed over to the left bank and found Shakespeare and Company Bookstore, the center of the English-speaking expatriate literary community in Paris for 89 years. I wonder if my mom knew about the bookstore. As a literature scholar, she likely did. In its two previous left bank locations, Shakespeare and Company was frequented by writers like Hemingway, Pound, Fitzgerald, and Stein. Sylvia Beach, the store's founder, published the first edition of Joyce's Ulysses. The store's current location, across the Seine from Notre Dame Square, was a haunt of Ginsberg and Burroughs, and now hosts another generation of young expat writers who exchange a few hours of work for lodging in bunks tucked among the upstairs bookshelves. If I could send her a postcard, I'd tell my mom the bookstore was crowded in every corner and to the beamed ceilings with its own history. A keyboard emerged from between a stack of books on the floor and books on what I realized were a piano's lid. Wood chairs and stools, no two alike, but all with layers of old, cracked paint, stood on the thread-worn carpets and bare stone floor in the narrow corridors and nooks. Even the stone ring of what had once been a well in the floor was topped with stacks of books. Coins dotted the cement 3 feet down, where the well had been filled in. Handbills for writers' groups and readings competed for space on the door, windows, and several bulletin boards. The scent of incense and clatter of a typewriter drifted down the steps. A black dog tugged playfully on a young woman's glove, refusing to let go. "Sorry, she does that a lot," the young woman behind the counter said in an Australian accent. It was impossible to take it all in at once, for me anyway. But Anya squeezed right past and headed up the stairs, between stacks of books on every tread, following the signs to the children's section. Amy subtly lifted her camera to her eye. In my daze, I found the handwritten Poets' Corner sign and spent a few minutes at the shelves there, scanning the spines for poets with Paris roots. Soon I had a little stack of books that included Apollinaire, Solon, Rimbaud, Valéry, and Villon. With the stack under my arm, I followed Anya upstairs, toward the sources of the typewriter clatter and incense, and found her engaged in conversation with an elderly lady. The woman thanked her in a French accent for her help and explained to me that Anya had been assisting her in selecting a book for her English granddaughter. If I could send my mom a postcard, I'd tell her how Anya said, "You're welcome," cheerfully, how the elderly woman paid her an au revoir and made her way carefully down between the books on the stairs, how Anya said, "I've got a stack too, Daddy," and showed me her books. If I could, I'd tell my mom about spotting the typist, a long-haired, bearded young man working away at the machine between a smoldering incense stick and a steaming cup of coffee, as Anya and I made our way through a sitting room and down a narrow hall walled in more bookshelves with curtained-off bunks here and there for young writers, through a doorway above which were painted the words, "Be not inhospitable to strangers, lest they be angels in disguise," and into a room lined with cushioned benches and still more bookshelves. Amy joined us, and I asked if she was taking some good photos. I think so, and I found a book. She handed me the novel Hunting and Gathering by Anna Gavalada, a story of Parisian misfits, the cover explained. Amy has a huge soft spot for misfits, wherever they may be. Lucky for me. I sat in one of the chairs at the window, overlooking Rue de la Boucherie, the Seine, and Notre Dame Square beyond. Cozied up next to a portable radiator, I scribbled in my pocket notebook and glanced now and then out at the streets, wet with rain again. Amy took my picture. It's good to have a partner who sees you as you enjoy imagining yourselves. I'm not a renowned writer. My books weren't downstairs on one of the shelves in Poet's Corner. But that was all right. My daughter was sitting across the room, paging through her illustrated Roman mythology. My wife was documenting our Paris afternoon with her camera, and I was doing so with my pen. The three of us were composing our own story. We were our own audience. That picture is the postcard I would send, if I could, to my mom. In the morning, on the train to the airport, an accordion player strolled into our car. He was playing "Those Were the Days." Decades before it was popularized in America in the 60s, my mother's golden youth, it was a Russian song. And as the accordionist weaved and staggered toward us through the rocking train, the song seemed to come from generations of people who were once young. "Notice," the accordion was telling us, "notice your life, the days passing each into the next, like these notes." When he was done, I put a couple brass-colored euro coins in the styrofoam cup he held as he passed on his way to the next car. I stared out the window. Scrapyards and gray housing projects of the Paris suburbs passed. In her youth, my mother had daydreamed of directing films. I let myself imagine the accordionist's song still playing in my head as her choice for this moment, as the romantic, already nostalgic accompaniment to the end of our 4 days in Paris. I cannot tell her about our little adventure, cannot give it to her for her to make of it a pleasant vision in her mind. But she would have loved it. And because I know she would have loved it, she can still remind me to notice, to be inside these days, and, as the song says, to live the life we choose. Pocket Journal Entry, Marquette, Day 4. February 5. Cleaned Mom's raw bed sores at 6 this morning. The key is to be methodical and smooth, to get through the pain as gently and quickly as possible, but to be deliberate with the swabbing and applying the fresh, soft moleskin dressing. Even so, she winced and her forehead creased with the hurt of our work. To keep the mood up, my sister Ann and I sang "Under the Boardwalk," a favorite of Mom's. It was a bit jumbled, but when I forgot some lyrics, I substituted, "Sheila, down by the Santa Monica Pier." We worked delicately but fast. Ann and I sang. Dad backed us with the refrain, "Under the boardwalk," and together the three of us repeated, "Boardwalk." Softly but clearly we sang, "On a blanket with my baby is where I'll be." Then we sang "California Girls," which made Dad tear up. When the bed sores were clean under fresh, smooth moleskin, Mom managed a few sips of orange electrolyte drink. We wetted her eyes with artificial teardrops, tucked her back under the covers, and sat around her on the bed until she was sleeping sweetly. Later in the morning, when Mom was awake again, she'd had some time when she seemed present, so I used it to say, "We're doing okay. Ann and Dad and I are getting through this. We're going to take care of each other and get through it." She'd opened her eyes and looked into mine, tiny pupils again, narrow openings between lids, and said completely clearly, "There will be times. Always thinking of us." I'd said, "How about during those times you come and be with us?" People visit. Rick, my college friend, has brought his little boy Ricky to show him to Mom. When Rick and I were young men, Mom and Rick connected as fellow lost family people. Rick was on his own then, an exile, if not an outright orphan like her. She made him welcome, listened to him talk about classes, girls, loneliness. Now he's driven 9 hours to show her his little son. He calls her the most wonderful person he knows. Others gather. My mom's brother and sister are here from far away to sit with her and stroke her hair and look at old family photos. My mom's sister-in-law has made the long journey too. Amy's sister comes by. And Amy is here, Mom's dear, dear friend and daughter-in-law, and Anya, the grandchild we gave her. The house fills with conversation. Life. Anya reads 3 or 4 books to her. She sits in my lap beside her and goes through the stuff she has memorized. When she's done, she asks Mom if she liked it, and Mom nods yes. At one point, when we were alone, I told Mom I was going to keep talking to her, going to keep her going in me. Her face was pained, I asked her if she wanted me to stop, if it hurt too much. No, she said, though she looked so sad. I told her I'd seen a heavy man walking across campus today. I said that while most people who would drive by wouldn't pay him much thought, or would think, there's a heavy guy, or worse, she would think, it must be hard to be in there. I hope he has some joy in his day, someone who cares about him. She nodded. I told her I would live to keep her compassion going. Tonight, after she fell asleep, I spent an hour cleaning her rump, trimming and replacing the soiled parts of the bedsore dressings. Because she was unconscious and seemed not to feel it, I took the time to work meticulously, cleaning and rinsing with Q-tips. Now comes an odd sensation of happiness to have done that. I hope she sleeps through the night, for her and me. Scotland, late winter and early spring. Back from Paris, we soon found our cottage turning into a cave around us. We made efforts to keep it from happening. We woke one morning to a real snowfall, a rarity in Crail, and went out and built two snowmen, one in front of our door and another out on the breakwater. Amy took photos of the wet snow piled on the lobster creels and gunwales of boats. We built a snow fort on the seawall, and Anya crawled in, and we all threw snowballs at one another. Our two snowmen stared at each other across the harbor for a few days as the temperature climbed and the sun broke out. But soon, they and the little snow fort on the seawall were smears of white, and then they were gone. The sun traded places with the clouds and mist. One morning we'd hear the small songs of returning birds through our curtains and single-pane windows. The next morning, we'd hear nothing but waves and battering wind. We got the flu. For 3 weeks, fever, chills, and cramps kept one of us under the covers and the other two in attendance and semi-housebound. The worst of the winter darkness was subsiding. Daylight was lingering until 5 now, rather than winking out at 3:30. But as the days of February dragged by, I became more and more aware that the walls around us were thick, cold stone. All three of us checked out on Scotland mentally. I began to daydream about someday buying a house in Marquette, and Amy browsed realty sites online. She wrote daily emails and made late-night calls to friends across the ocean. Anya got out library books on raising gerbils and explained to us that when we get back home, she'll need to get more than one. Otherwise, they get lonely, she explained. One alone will try to dig right through the wood chips in its cage to find others. And were Amy and I imagining it? Or did we notice that Anya seemed to be spending time alone in the schoolyard before the morning bell? Were her friends grouping up with other kids and excluding her? While the other parents attempted to make idle chat with us, we stood in the drizzle at the school gate and kept our eyes on Anya's red jacket, which seemed to move from cluster to cluster and kept ending up alone. After the bell rang and kids went inside, we would go back to the cottage where Amy would cry and ask me what had gone wrong. Maybe her friends are starting to realize she'll be leaving in a few months, I guessed. I don't know. It was going so well for her, I don't get it. Amy wondered if Anya's tendency to form one or two close friendships had backfired on her. Or maybe it was her affectionate nature and other kids were cutting her off, as kids will, just because they could. Amy lost a lot of sleep. But we kept trying. We read Harry Potter aloud every night. We played cards and dice and Clue. We held hands around the dinner table and took turns telling what we were grateful for. Each other, our returning health, our cottage, the steaming salmon and rice and carrots on our plates. We really tried. But then Anya would ask if we'd mind too much if she played one of her computer games before bed, and Amy and I would welcome the chance to plop down on the sofa and numb out in front of some BBC drama on TV. And then I'd ask myself again what the point in coming here had been, as the walls around us once again insisted on their stones, and the curtains and door on the front of the cave stayed tightly shut to the indifferent lighthouse pulsing out on the indifferent sea. To what extent Anya's recent social difficulties result from her foreignness, I haven't yet been able to ascertain. But even as she keeps trying, her troubles go on. Yesterday, she invited over Lily and Emma, her two best friends from her class, for pizza and milkshakes and a movie. Amy and I had suggested the get-together after Anya told us she was feeling excluded, even from those kids to whom she had, until recently, felt closest. The three girls were in Anya's room while Amy was downstairs making the shakes, and I heard Lily and Emma's voices and the sound of Anya's crying. I tapped on the door and saw Lily and Emma on one side of the bed and Anya on the far side, tears welling in her eyes. "What's going on?" I asked. Anya's tears ran down her cheeks, and Lily giggled nervously. I put my arm around Anya. "She's crying and you're giggling?" I asked sharply. Anya couldn't bring herself to say anything, but Emma and Lily fell all over each other to explain that Anya hadn't helped them with the team challenge that day at school. "So you're making her cry?" Then I pulled out the big ammo. Things they didn't know, I knew. "Lily, I've heard that groups of girls at school have excluded you lately. And Emma, didn't Abby and Ellie make you cry at school a couple days ago?" The girls nodded, relieved to be painted as fellow victims rather than perpetrators. "Well, I think it's pretty disappointing that the three of you can't be good to one another, can't stick together and be kind." I asked if I should take them home, and Anya shook her head no vigorously and looked pleadingly into my eyes.
"No, no," Lily said. "We're the BFF club," Emma said. "Best friends forever," Lily insisted.
"Well, kindness only in our house is the rule," I said, and retreated, leaving the door ajar. 2 minutes later, I heard them all giggling and wrestling on the bed. But then, once the movie started, there was a squabble because Lily wanted Emma to sit in the middle. And then again, this morning in the schoolyard, Anya seemed to spend the long minutes before the first bell alone. The sun is out today. I ran the shore path, past the ruined cottage and alongside waves tossing over the rocks, as B.B. King sang in my headphones, "The Thrill Is Gone." I came home and sat beside Amy on the couch, and we talked about Anya's troubles until we'd said everything we could think to say. Maybe she should just be homeschooled for the remainder of our time here. Or maybe that would be the worst thing for her confidence and skills, especially given how much she seems to be enjoying her academic activity. Currently, a report on Pluto she's happily researching. Maybe her friends are pulling back because they realize she'll be leaving. Maybe the intensity of Anya's affection and loyalty has put them off. Maybe it's us and how much time she spends with us and other adults. Maybe she's actually more socially advanced. She seems to get on consistently well with kids a couple years older than herself. Maybe she lets her needs show and thereby has driven kids away. I want to call my mom, to hear her voice reassuring me from Marquette as it did through my first nearly 4 years of being Anya's dad. I try, but today I cannot conjure what my mom would have said. The songbirds have returned. I can hear them this morning on the roof. Anya is still feeling disconnected from the girls in her grade, but she invited over Alice and Marion, the twins, for a play date. They are 2 years older than Anya, and big fans of Harry Potter. The three got on wonderfully. They made a fort of the couch, chairs, and blankets in the living room, and crawled in with headlamps on their heads. Amy went to see Mrs. Lang, Anya's teacher, and spoke with her about the isolation Anya's been telling us about. Supportive and encouraging as ever, Mrs. Lang said that Anya continues to do well in her studies, but there has been a noticeable dip in her social confidence. She said she'd keep an eye out for ways she could help, that she'd be rearranging the class seating, and she'll put Anya with some kids who seem particularly warm. Of course, Amy's still concerned, but she's stopped weeping daily. To make things even brighter, our first of many scheduled spring visitors has arrived with the songbirds. A friend and former student of mine, Jame, is a long-haired, flannel-clad Seattle bohemian who is also so conscientious and responsible that Amy and I trusted him to be Anya's first babysitter. But what I love most about Jame is his largeness of heart. His kindness and interpersonal attentiveness make him one of what I think of as my mother's people, those rare individuals one meets every year or two, if one is lucky enough, whose very core is compassion, for whom the well-being and contentment of others is their deepest motivator and concern. They are a tribe, dispersed across time and geography, but they are easily recognized by those of us who have loved one of them. Jame, Amy, Anya, and I drive through the highlands and over the bridge to the Isle of Skye. In the pier restaurant in the village of Portree, we are the first customers of the spring season. We sit beside the window with a full moon on the fishing boats at anchor. When, for conversation, I ask everyone what personal quality they'd most like to have more of, James answers, grace. Grace, of course. Who besides those who already have it could think to want more, above all other qualities? James tells me I was a good teacher for him, but it's James who teaches me now. Though he never met her, his word teaches me what my mother's people wish for when they wish for themselves. A turn in the tide for Anya. Maybe. Emma and Lily each invite her for play dates. She turns them down. She tells us she'd rather be home playing with Amy and me. Everything's okay, though, we ask, and she tells us yeah. All the kids are being nice to her again. Emma and Lily have told her they really want to be friends, and she's once again in a bright mood when we pick her up, eager to tell us what's new. Today, it's a sticker on her uniform sweatshirt for playing a good game of cricket. She skips toward home as she tries to explain the rules to me. Still, much as things seem to be improving in her social life, she'd rather spend her free time with us instead of other kids in the village. Once bitten, twice shy, it seems. It's okay, I suppose, her choosing her family over friends right now. The sun's come out, and mid-March feels like much later spring. I think I'll suggest we take a picnic out to the shore.
More company from across the Atlantic. For 3 years before we moved to Scotland, cousin Jennifer lived in our house while attending college and was like a sister to Anya. It was Jennifer who introduced Anya to Harry Potter. Jennifer, with whom Anya first climbed our backyard trees. She has an unfailingly cheerful disposition, and having her here makes Scotland feel a little more like home. Jennifer shared her flight over with some of our beloved family friends who have come to visit for a week. And so we've recreated our American household in our Crail cottage, the adults putting the pajama-clad little people to bed, and then back to bed, and then back to bed one last time. Amy the next morning teasing Jennifer she slept late so there's no hot water left, and Jennifer half believing her when in fact the tank's long since recovered from the early riser's bathing and breakfast dishes. At the moment, Amy, Anya, Jennifer, and our friends from home are down on the beach, and I'm alone with my window onto the sea and my pen and paper. In her last years, my mom spent her share of time alone, her husband off in his professor role in front of class, her son on one side of the country, and her daughter on the other, the upper Michigan night out her window. She often told me she was grateful for this solitary time. I suppose solitude is how some of us perfect our loves for one another. Me here at my desk, while my little congregation plays downshore. My mom in her wheelchair at the dining room table and looking out into a blizzard, dark in the night, through which the strongest affection and the best of good wishes traveled easily. Mothering Sunday, the third Sunday of March in the UK. We're back in the Highlands, back at Glenfinnan House Hotel, this old manor of high ceilings, flickering candles, and oil paintings on the shore of my mother's near namesake loch, Loch Shiel. When we asked our friend Chris what she and her kids, Dylan and Hallie, would like to see in Scotland, and they answered the Highlands, I jumped at the chance to stay here again. So I'm up late, writing once again in this wing-back chair next to the fire in the lobby fireplace. It seems odd to me, of course, to have Mothering Sunday come so early compared to the American Mother's Day in May. Odd, but fitting. Today, the daffodils were up. The songbirds were back. We saw 4 early lambs in fields on the drive up from Crail. The world is on the brink of remaking itself, of handing down life to a new generation. Once we had checked into the hotel, I celebrated the day with my mother by speaking to her as I ran 18 miles of dirt road alongside the wild loch she never saw, never even heard of, as far as I know, but that her son has come to love through eyes trained to the world's companionability by her. She was here, in the wind and clouds and rain and sunlight, moving between the steep slopes rising from the loch, because
I was here. As I ran, I told her how Anya's getting on, that February was tough, but it's 3 weeks behind us, and today's a new day. The wind and rain sculpted my jacket to the contours of my body, and I told her that I've made peace, for now anyway, with losing the audience I imagined my Keats and Fanny film would have found. That I've made peace generally with my work's lack of audience. I don't need to be famous, I said. The work makes my soul larger, sustains it at least. In turn, I'm better able to love your sweet friend and daughter-in-law, and your little sprite, the one who made you Nana, and who, God willing, will carry both your spirit and mine on in the world. The lock moved rows of white waves, like choral voices over its blue-black depths. The low sky was darkening. It would be night soon. My feet moved over the packed dirt road. I jumped puddles. They're back there, I nodded up the lock. Soon I'd be able to see the lights of the hotel through the dusk and gauzes of rain moving just above the water. Thank you, I said, for this life, for my feeling so alive in it, and for teaching me to love. And then it came to me, clear as if her voice were speaking it. With them is where I find her most. Ever since she died, it has seemed that there should be somewhere I could go to find her. Scotland, the seaside, this lock, the cottage in which her beloved Wordsworth lived, the hills he walked, her Marquette dining room table where she sat looking out the picture window at the dark and loving us out there. So often I've felt this overwhelming sense that if I could just find the right place, I'd find her. But it's with them, I said through my hard breaths as I ran. That's where you are, where you've been all along, where you'll remain. Now, as I write this, the logs in the fire are glowing, crumbled orange blocks that send up flickers of flame. From the pub down the hall, there's fiddle music, the sound of glasses being washed and shelved. The gusting wind puffs billows of smoke up in front of the mantel once in a while and rattles across the tall, dark windows. And home is my family and dear friends asleep upstairs.
That brings us to the end of tonight's episode of The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. Thank you for listening. Join us next time to continue Jonathan's story. Music for this episode is by Caerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.